When people become interested in the gospel message of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God, they should want to first prove that God does exist. Now, one reason is because there is no escaping the constant barrage of the teaching that evolution is a proven fact. This philosophical teaching is ingrained throughout every area of our culture today. Man explains everything about life and existence based on evolution. We are here today, brethren, because we have proved to ourselves that God does exist and that He is real, that He is not just a religious idea. Well, as Christians, can we answer some of the major evolutionary arguments that are taught to our children in school or that we are confronted with on occasion as adults? Now, we look at many times doctrines that we would call false teachings about Christianity, and we try to explain, and so that you can also be able to explain to those who would challenge you to give an answer for the hope that lies within. What about this subject? I think it's very important that we look at this as well. So today, I would like to look at some, not all, but some of the major problems in evolution, and also look at some of the major evidences for God. And some is the word I will use because we can be here throughout the next week if you want to go through all of the major evidences for God. They are incredible, but I will hit upon some things that I think are very big that we should look at and that we can develop in our own study to add to even more so. First, does it matter one way or the other whether you believe in evolution or God? Can you believe in both? By the way, some religious people do just that. There are ministers of denominations that believe and teach what is called theistic evolution, that God created everything by evolution. So does it really matter then? Can we just say, well, who cares? Either side you want to go with, it'll be okay. Well, the answer is no. It certainly does matter. Why? Why does it matter? Well, if there is no God, then we are just the product of time and chance, aren't we? We do not have to give any regard to God or His Word. We have no purpose for being on this earth. This life is all there is, and there is no hope of eternal life. Now, if God does exist, then we are not an accident, are we? We are meant to be here. There is a purpose for our existence. We are responsible to our Creator, and we realize there is hope to live beyond this life. We all agree on the latter portion, and we recognize, indeed, that God does exist. So, yes, it does matter to know the difference, be able to give an answer for the hope that lies within. Now, since it does matter, then what are some of the major problems to begin with before we get to the evidences and proof of God? What are some of the major problems with evolution that either you as an adult can answer when somebody begins to try to challenge you or to be able to point to your children? Now, what a lot of you parents who have young children, you're finding out they are being exposed to evolutionary teaching in elementary school much sooner than when I grew up and began to hear about it. And so what do you tell them? I guess, first of all, you have to find out a little bit of what they are told so that you then can begin to give some response to the situation. I want to begin by looking at some of the problems. And the first one is to understand what's really behind it by asking the question, is it science or is it philosophy? Well, the answer is, I think you can tell by the question, that it is philosophy. It really is not science at all. I'd like to share some things with you here. I have a book, The 10 Things That You Should Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate, and it's by an author named Ron Rose. It's quite well written, and it doesn't have to be a huge 2-inch thick encyclopedia-type book to be able to get down to the basics and keep it within the simplicity. A lot of times Satan and all of the things that he tries to deceive people with is by making it too complicated. And it does not have to be. We can simply get down to the simplistics of the whole thing. Under the second chapter, evolutionism rests on the foundation of naturalism. This is very important to understand when you're looking at it to begin with, that you're dealing with a philosophy. Naturalism is a system of thought that espouses the idea that all phenomena in the universe can be explained wholly in terms of natural causes and laws. Now, when you think about that, that there's no God, there's no miracle, that everything just naturally happens, do you realize what had to naturally happen without any intelligent design or cause behind it to get to where we are today with our minds, with our organisms, with our eyes and our ears? It requires faith that I know none of you have. And I certainly do not have that kind of faith to believe in that either. Nature is the whole show. No supernatural being intervenes in the natural world. Naturalists reject miracles outright. In other words, it's just naturally happening, always to the good, to come from the simple to the complex. Paragraphs here I'd like to read. Naturalism virtually rules the academic world. Its presence is oppressively felt in public schools, colleges, and universities across the country. Naturalism has been called, quote, the default position for all serious inquiry, and predominates in education, law, the arts, and, of course, science. Many of today's intellectual attacks against the Bible and Christianity and creationism are rooted in naturalism. It just all just naturally has occurred, and that's all there is to it. I have another little book here that I thought was quite good by an author named Philip E. Johnson. He's a professor at the University of California, entitled in his book, Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds. Very interesting. This individual debates some of the major evolutionists in the world. And he even has gone on with people like Richard Dawkins in England and so on. He's written quite a number of books, but this was written for parents primarily because of the things that they will face with their children. How do Christian parents answer some of the things that are throw into their kids? The kids come home not knowing what to say or how to answer or what to think even in some situations. Going along with the fact that it's philosophy based on naturalism, Philip Johnson says that evolution is not a fact, it's a philosophy. The materialism, he calls it materialism in place of naturalism, comes first, and the evidence is interpreted in light of that unchangeable philosophical commitment. If the evidence seems to go against the philosophy, so much the worse for the evidence. To a materialist or a naturalist, putting up with any amount of bad practice in science is better than to let the divine foot in the door. I mean, it is a philosophical state of mind, which he rightfully and correctly points out. And that's really the first thing when you begin, and I'm not going to go through all things about evolution, but I am going to point out several things that just simply shows that it cannot be. Herbert Armstrong once said that when he was coming into the church, as we would look at it today, back in 1926, 27, in that period of time, was a sister-in-law who was a librarian there in, I think it was Portland, Oregon. Herbert, you're a fool for believing in God. Don't you know we've evolved? Maybe you remember that. If some of you, going back 50 years, understand some here were here 50 years ago when you had your anniversary the other day. You'll recall in Volume 1 of the autobiography, he talks about that. He goes on to say he was challenged at that time when he was just brand new. And he realized, before I can disprove these things about the Sabbath to my wife, remember that in that winter 6-month study that he was going through? I realized, he went on to say, I had to prove that God does exist. I grew up always believing it, but I had never been challenged in any way such as this, and especially when somebody calls me a fool and before believing in God and everything. Later on, he talks about how that he got to the trunk of the tree. on evolution to the and saw that it was absolutely impossible and could not happen. We're going to look at several of those things here today, why it's impossible, and it has never happened. It has never happened. Let me go on here. Just a summary of this one point about philosophy. We can see that the philosophy of naturalism and materialism is something that frankly trumps true science. It really does, because it doesn't matter if the science is shown to be wrong and is incomplete and not there. We believe it anyhow. I've run into people like this on other religious topics too at times. Don't confuse me with the facts. This is what I want to believe. Have you run into people like that? Really? I mean, it's a shame. It's sad. You would think everybody would have an open, objective mind and want to seek truth. But a lot of times, emotion and philosophy gets in the way. And people simply say, basically, they don't say it outright, but you can see, you can read it by the way they're responding. Don't confuse me with the facts. This is what I'm going to believe. We don't want to be that way. That's not God called us to prove Him, right? And to hold fast to that which is true. All right, why do people have this kind of attitude and philosophy? They're not uneducated. They're some of the most educated people on this earth. And you know, you look at the degrees after their names and so forth. Well, the answer is very simple. It's right here in Romans chapter 8 and verse 7. Because the carnal mind, the fleshly mind, is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. Now, I don't care how educated somebody is in the ways of this world, his mind is still enmity against God because it is carnal. And many of these individuals, they simply refuse to admit in any way that they could possibly be wrong or that what they believe in, which is really their religion, that it is in any way wrong. They go to great extent to stop any opposition. The teaching of intelligent design, which in recent years you've heard about, I'm sure, they'll go to court. They will do everything they can to shut them up and not allow the other side to be presented. Why, even the Supreme Court of the United States in 1987, the majority opinion was that it was religion and we cannot allow that in the in any kind of school. The dissenter, Antoine, what's his name? Supreme Court Justice, who's always a conservative man, Scalia, Antoine Scalia, that he dissented and he said he could not see any reason why there could not be the objective teaching on both sides, and that, in other words, if there are problems with evolution, it should be challenged just as they want to challenge religion. And but, of course, he was voted 5-4, I think it was, in 1987 decision. Another scripture that certainly tells the story as to why people who supposedly are greatly educated yet insist on believing something that, as we're going to see as we go along, has never happened and cannot be proven. And that is here in Jeremiah 17 and in verse 9. Jeremiah 17 and in verse 9, it says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? These people do not realize their heart is desperately wicked when they deny God. And they will not submit to God. Now, there's scriptures that say in the end that every knee will bow to me, to God. And if they have to be broken, they will come down either voluntarily or involuntarily. Every knee will bow to God eventually. But God gives all time and opportunity for people whose hearts at the present may be hardened, that one day they may be softened and actually voluntarily want to turn and surrender to Him. I could give you a number of books of individuals. I have one that I've always used, and I've referred to it even when I've spoken at the feast a couple times. An author named Lee Strobel, who used to be the worked for the Chicago Tribune as the investigative reporter, I think it was, on criminal cases and so on. He uses that approach. He interviews a number of people, scientists and so forth, who believe in God, And he really grills them, too, with some very skeptical questions, that type of thing, to see how they're going to respond. His book, A Case for Creationism, is very, very good because it's not Lee Strobel's opinion. And he really backs things up. In fact, some of the authors we have used in articles we've written over the years here in the church, Michael Behe, biochemistry professor at Lehigh University, the one who's written quite a bit on DNA, and I'll come to that later, is interviewed in that book as well. Let's move on then. Certainly, the first thing you want to understand, parents or adults, if you are challenged, am I dealing here with science or am I dealing with philosophy? Now, they're going to tell you if you ask them that question, well, of course it's science. Don't you know that? All right. Very good. I'm glad you answered it that way, because now I want to look for the observable evidence. I want to see the scientific evidence, because ever since I graduated from college and even before that time, they were stating it's now a proven fact, and I want to see the facts. And you should, too, because a lot of times, as you're going to see, it is just so much talk and philosophy. All right, first thing that I wanted to approach here on this, one of the major things, you're dealing with philosophy. You're not really dealing with science. And if they want to say it's science, you have an opportunity right there. Prove it. Let's see you prove it. All right, secondly, I want to talk about one thing that's very important to understand the difference. Microevolution is not macroevolution. That's one of the very important things. Well, you probably ask, well, what's that? That sounds like a big word. Well, yeah, it is in one sense. It's not a word that we commonly use. Micro is small change. Macro, obviously, is very large change. Macroevolution is moving into a new species, from one species to the next, which has never happened. It has never happened. Let me just share something here, and then I'll comment a little bit more on this as we move along. And it is important to understand, why am I talk about this? Because microevolution does exist. Macroevolution does not. And don't be fooled, because scientists will take the changes that are in microevolution and will say, see, that's macroevolution. That's change taking place. I'll give you an example here in just a moment. Let me read again here from Rhodes' book. Simply put, microevolution refers to changes that occur within the same species, while macroevolution refers to the transition or evolution of one species into another. Macroevolution consists of changes within a population, leading to a completely new species with genetic information that did not exist in any of the parents. Creationists and evolutionists agree that microevolution has taken place. Creationists believe all the different races of human beings descended from a single common human ancestor, Adam. Likewise, all kinds of dogs have microevolved from the original dog species created by God. In no case, however, have scientists ever observed macroevolution. I argue later in the book that the genetic pool of DNA in each species sets parameters beyond which the species simply cannot evolve. That is, dogs can take on new characteristics, but they cannot evolve into cats. For dog DNA always remains dog DNA, just as cat DNA always remains cat DNA. It will never change. There is not one shred of evidence anywhere that that has ever taken place, forming a new species whatsoever. Charles Darwin, in 1858-59, when he was on his tour around the world and stopped in the Galapagos Islands, he observed that the bird, the finch, there on the Galapagos Islands, would begin to, as he looked at it, evolve, making a change in its beak based upon the weather conditions, drought and that type of thing, feeding conditions changing, that the beak would get smaller, I guess it was, and then as things changed, they realized then it actually adapted and its beak would get longer. And he thought that was an evidence possibly of an evolution. It is microevolution, adapting to changes in nature. The thing was that the finch has never become anything more than a finch, and always is a finch and always will remain a finch, even though because of the conditions of feeding and weather and so forth may change its size of its beak at times. National Geographic, I believe, is where I saw it a number of years ago. A biologist accompanied by actor Alan Alda were in the Galapagos, and the biologist was showing Alan Alda the finch. And you see how here, beak has changed. I forgot what direction it was, going up or going down and everything. And he was just smiling. And that's the most wonderful thing. He says, see, here's, you see evolution at work right here. Now, that biologist was not ignorant. Yet he was claiming microevolution as macroevolution. And it was not. It was simply the fact that it was adapting to what was taking place in the nature of the Galapagos Islands at that time. And it would change back later. It would never become anything else. It will not evolve into a turtle or anything else into a new species. It will always be a finch. It always has been a finch, just the way God created. One of the things discovered is the DNA, which I just read here and mentioned about, because the DNA will allow the microevolution, but not macroevolution, into another and total different species. Now, you have heard where scientists try to say that birds came from the dinosaurs. And we know, as a fact, that birds have evolved from certain dinosaurs and that the scales have evolved into feathers. Oh, really? That sounds quite interesting. Can you show me any evidence of that in the fossil records? Now, of course, the biologist who is telling the kids in the class that is not going to tell them there is none whatsoever. There never has been. And that is one of the biggest problems of all. It is not there. Now, let me go on with this a little bit, because certainly there is no evidence in the fossil record of macroevolution. But don't be fooled, because when scientists try to tell you, or teachers or whatever, that, see, look at this finch. See how it's changed. That's evolution. That is microevolution. That is nothing. We agree. I mean, how did you get all the different types of dogs and cats? But not, and there's, has you ever heard of a dog or a cat or any animal macro evolving into some other species other than what it already was? No. And that's the way that's exactly what God created with us human beings. We have all kinds of different human beings. White, black, Asiatic, then you have within them three major races, all the different ethnic groups. Guess what? We all have the spirit of man, and we're all the same. We may have certain different proclivities physically, maybe some even mental things as well, that we have strengths and weaknesses, don't we? God wants it that way. We develop all of those things. And just like we were watching a dog show, where was it, here the other day, they were showing on TV at my son's house, and I said, oh, it was Thanksgiving Day, and I said to Dave, is that live? He said, yeah, that's live. It was going on Thursday, wherever it was coming from. Beautiful dogs. The owners are prancing around the arena with these dogs. The dogs are prancing pretty fast. You get winded there watching it. But beautiful animals. Guess what? They're all dogs. And they're always going to breed dogs. And they may breed different types of dogs within but they'll always be dogs. Let me move on, because I want to watch my time here as we get into this subject and continue on it. There is no evidence of macroevolution in the fossil record. Now let's go to the fossil record. Number three here. First, you have to understand you're dealing with philosophy and people who are stuck on a philosophy, not on science, because they have scientific proof. They don't. Second, they're using microevolution to say that macroevolution has taken place and formed everything you see on this earth. Wrong. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. Now, number three, let's look at intermediate fossils. Do they show a transition of one species into another? The answer is no, they do not. Again, let me read here from Ron Rhodes' book. I thought it was very good quotes here from it. The more one studies the fossil records, the more one finds a lack of evidence to support evolution. If evolution were true, one would expect to see in the fossil records progressively complex evolutionary forms, indicating transitions of one life form into another life form. We should see fish transitioning into reptiles, and some ancient ancestor life form transitioning into apes and into humans. However, out of all the billions of fossils known and documented in the rocks of the Earth's crust, no such evidence exists. The British Museum of History alone contains some 60 million fossil specimens. Yet not one is a transitional form showing one species is evolving into another. Rather, the evidence reveals a sudden appearance of life forms, and each of them exhibits all the features that distinguish that life form, fully formed, fully functional, with no evolving of body parts involved. We find no ancestors with stubs on their lower bodies that gave rise to species with legs. We find no ancestors with stubs on their sides that gave rise to species with wings. Such Darwinian gradualism is completely absent from the record. Now, the oldest strata is called the Cambrian strata. And the Cambrian strata is where the explosion of life begins, because before, if you go lower in the strata that is laid down showing older time period, pre-Cambrian, there is no life. When you start in the Cambrian strata, there it is. Full life. All sea creatures and life. By the way, if you want to see some of that, you get a chance to go to Arizona to the Grand Canyon. Go in on the south rim. Take a left and head west down the trail till you come to the spot called Hermit's Rest. The signs are there. Keep your hands off the trilobites of the Cambrian age. That whole area, of course, was underwater at one time. Some massive destruction, I don't believe for one minute, I don't think you would either, caused that canyon to be formed. It wasn't that little tiny river called the Colorado River down there a mile away from you. It is canyons within canyons. It is so big, it is so enormous. Of course, then you're starting to think, where did all that go? Where did all that land go, the rock and everything that was there at one time? And then at Hermit's Rest, they're sticking out of rocks. They're laying out there exposed. At least they were when we were there many, many years ago as students. Going between Pasadena and Big Sandy, we'd stop at the Grand Canyon. And that was quite an interesting thing, just to walk around Hermit's Rest and take a look at what was there. You've seen pictures of trilobites that are extinct. You can go over there and see them, the fossils there in the rocks and laying on the ground. Of course, it's been a long time. I don't know what they've done to, they were wanting to protect it. They didn't want people picking them up and put them in their pockets and all of that. So I haven't been back in a long time, but I would imagine that the Park Service has done an awful lot to try to make sure they preserve that and that it is not destroyed or lost. But you'll find in the Cambrian age that was a strata, you had a complete, in every one of those areas where you go into the strata, you have a complete life in there. There's nothing partial, and they are all complete and functional in every way. Let me also read another thing here concerning this, because from Johnson's book here on the Defeating Darwinism. I'll get to it here in just a moment. There is no fossil history of single-celled organisms changing step-by-step into complex plants and animals. Parents, you need to know that. We all need to know that. When somebody says it's a proven fact, they cannot prove it. And when you challenge them, I want to see the proof. Is this science or is this philosophy? If it's science, you show me the evidence. There is no fossil history of single-celled organisms changing step by step into complex plants and animals. Now, science says that everything began with simple, one-celled creatures, amoeba, protozoa. The emphasis is on simple. Nothing simple about a one-celled creature, because in its nucleus of that one cell is what is called DNA. And there is in that DNA information. Chemicals coming together in a soup of a sea, which is the way they described that it happened, coming together and then suddenly living, and not only that, reproducing themselves and forming the entire plant kingdom on this earth, the entire animal kingdom in the sea and on the land on this planet. Millions of species of plants and animal life all came from a couple chemicals that came together and then they started living. You challenge anyone who believes that. If it is so simple and you're so smart, let's say you make it. Not only make it, you make it live and you make it reproduce itself. They cannot do it. They can't even come close. DNA has information. And there is a source for information. Chemicals do not carry information. Yet DNA has information and it tells the rest of the body or the cells what to do. And for that organism and not for any other organism, it doesn't jump from one to the other. It's an incredible thing when you look at it. And when you begin to see how phenomenal it is, you just shake your head. Why are you so stubborn that you still want to claim there is no God? On the contrary, the major groups of animals all appear suddenly in the rocks of the Cambrian era, and no new groups appear thereafter. High school textbooks either fail to mention this fundamental fact of the fossil record or refer to it so obliquely that students don't see the implications. That's right. Biology teacher in high school is not going to tell you that. I tell you it's a proven fact. We know evolution has taken place. Although, we do have a problem with finding the fossils. I move on quickly now to the next subject, right? Why not be honest and let the students know? And parents, you can point that out. In fact, that might be a good question for your son or daughter to ask the teacher. Where is the fossil record showing the invertebrate, soft-shelled creatures evolving into a vertebrate creature with backbones? Where is that in the fossil record? The answer is, it's never been there. It's never been there. They cannot answer the question. Something else then, because some scientists finally recognize we have a problem here. We've got to make a change in how we're presenting this because we finally have to admit we do not have the fossils to back this up. So two scientists came up with what they thought was a great way to explain it and still no God, right? It's amazing how man will go to any extent whatsoever to keep God out of his thinking and not admit what is the obvious. So let me just share this with you. In view of this, I'm breaking in here, evolutionists Niles Eldridge and Stephen J. Gould, big name, by the way, both of them in evolution, in 1972 proposed a theory known as punctuated equilibrium. This theory suggests that the fossil record may not be as imperfect as everyone thought. Quote, maybe the gaps are a true reflection of what really happened, rather than being the annoying but inevitable consequences of an imperfect fossil record. According to this theory, the development of new species occurred in spurts of major genetic alterations that punctuate long periods of little change. Now, this is philosophy. The long period of stasis or equilibrium, is the portion of the process referred to as the period of equilibrium and the interval characterized by rapid evolution, so fast that it's not in the fossil record, happened literally overnight, is a punctuation, thus the term punctuated equilibrium. More precisely, this theory postulates, that's what it does, it postulates that evolution is sometimes in equilibrium and no evolution occurs. But when evolution does occur, it happens in rapid spurts of major genetic alterations where new species can arise. Just suddenly happens. Suddenly from invertebrate to vertebrate just overnight. So there's nothing in the fossil record. And how do we know that's true? Well, because we look and we see that they're all here. And it couldn't have happened because there's a God. These rapid spurts punctuate, periodically interrupt, long periods of time when nothing happens. These spurts of evolution are typically followed by a long period of stasis or equilibrium where everything just stays the same. Well, there's one big problem with that. There is nothing in the fossil record to give any evidence of that, and if they cannot prove or observe it, it's just throwing out, it's a good story, isn't it? A lot of people believe that. Because Stephen Jay Gould and Neil Eldridge said so. Stephen Jay Gould is now deceased. He was one of the big names along with Richard Dawkins and others of the evolutionists and atheists of the world. And, okay, Mr. Gould, you've got to be able to prove it. Look, there are people out in California, I've seen them interviewed on TV, that believe the earth is flat. And they sit there and they are so convinced in their mind that this earth is flat. And the rest of us are all dumb to believe that it's round. And you ask them, well, where's the evidence? And if it's flat and you get to the end, have you ever looked over yet to see what's down there? you can have a little fun with some of this. But then get back to the serious part of it, though. There is no evidence. There is no evidence whatsoever in the fossil record. There is no way that, quote, punctuated equilibrium has any basis of fact, certainly has no proof behind it whatsoever. Move on, number four, mutations. Most all of your scientists and evolutionists say that everything happened by mutation. Mutations do bring about new mutations do not bring about new species. But keep in mind, mutations do take place in all organisms, living organisms. Most of the time, mutation is harmful to that organism. It is not something that is beneficial or profitable to it. But they have tried to postulate that it was by mutations that we came to where we are today. Let me read again from Rhodes. I'm not sure if he has it in his quote. I'm going to read to you. If not, I'll tell you how many mutations it would take to get to where you are today, from where you had to have come from. You know how much it would take? Even Charles Darwin was stymied by the human eye. How can the human eye evolve from gradual to complex? Because along the way, other parts of the body and everything in the brain have to be evolving too, if that's the case. It can't just be one organ system at one time. The mutations that would have to have taken place are absolutely phenomenal to come to the point where we have vision and in color. And you know another phenomenal thing about this vision? You drive out of this driveway and you look both ways before you turn, right? You see a car coming, let's say, from the south. You instantly, without even thinking, your vision judges the speed of that car and whether it's safe for you to pull out or not. We don't even think about that. We watch a baseball game and we see a pitch being thrown. The batter is able to train his eye through practice, be able to pick up the speed of that ball to be able to time the step into it, the swing, and hit it. The mathematical formulas, everything that would be needed to do that are phenomenal, and then we do it automatically. It's just all done. Just all done automatically. To see it, to be able to pick up the curveball, to be able to pick up anything like that. To judge instantly speed. Coming back here, many, many phenomenal things. There is no explanation that man can give that it can come about by natural selection. Sorry, let me quickly move here because a few things and I will move along. Evolution has no intelligent deterministic element. All right, there's no God if you're an evolutionist. So you have nothing behind all of this that has to happen. Because natural selection is a mindless, blind, unconscious, purposeless process, it is not capable of making and fulfilling long-range goals. Only an intelligent being can do that, right? How can natural selection, where there's no God, no miracle, do that? And if it cannot make and fulfill long-range goals, how could natural selection bring about the development of an eye, step by step, generation by generation, over a long period of time? Such a concept stretches the limits of credulity. It certainly does. To compound the problem, the eye is only one among many complex organs in a human being. What about the ear, the brain, the heart, the liver, the kidneys, the nervous system, the nose with its sense of smell? Are we to believe that again and again natural selection blindly, mindlessly brought about complex organs via a step-by-step, generation-by-generation process over a long period of time? No wonder Darwin expressed doubts about how this could work. To imagine that natural selection could blindly and mindlessly construct a complex organ like an eye or ear makes about as much sense as imagining that dropping my television would result in an improved version. You know, yes, might as well slam the TV down, and that's about as much of a chance as there would be here that that type of thing could actually happen. I always enjoyed the study of anatomy, human anatomy, when we did have some of it in biology class, as I best remember back when I was in high school. To me, it was a phenomenal thing to see how all of what's inside of us works. There are doctors who are surgeons who also believe in evolution. And I, of course, there are many doctors who don't. But I can't believe how any would when they open up a human being and do surgery to help them to whatever it is that needs to be done. And they study and they see how everything works. Can that just happen by time and chance? And just all come together? The one thing I don't have the quote on here, it's in the book. To get from the single cell, simple single cell creature to you and I would require, if mutations, if they were positive mutations, always positive mutations, which they are not, by the way, majority of them are all harmful to the creature in most all cases. You know how many it would take to get to where we are today? 3 trillion mutations. 3 trillion mutations, 3 trillion plus mutations. All of them beneficial. All of them beneficial. When most of your mutations that take place are not beneficial to the animal or to the human being if it's with a human being. And all of that just happened by time and chance. And no intelligence behind it. No God behind it. Well, obviously that looks kind of silly and ridiculous. All right, mutations do not bring about a new species. Don't be fooled by that, because I've heard that by scientists even on television say that it was through mutations that we've come to where we are. Of course, the person interviewing the guy didn't know enough to ask the right questions and challenge him. You mean to tell me that 3 trillion mutations took place? Because that's what it would be, over 3 trillion mutations, positive mutations, to get from one cell to you and I today. And that just is not going to happen and never has, never will. The last thing I want to touch on before going on to some things about God and the proof of God. Ape men do not prove evolution. Ape men do not prove evolution. I recall in college many, many years ago at Portland State when I was there, the guy was a nice man, I have to admit. And he was talking in this geology class I was in, and he said, now you can go anywhere on this earth and you see it once was underwater, just as the Bible says. It was all covered by water. And then he pauses and he follows up by saying, but we know that man has evolved from the apes. No, he has not. And you do not know that. You do not know that. You want to believe it, but you do not know that. All right. Let me, this man you might know. read here from Rhodes. You'll see in a minute. Beginning in the 1950s, however, scholars began to change their minds, especially in view of the fact that similar remains had been discovered in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Who are we talking about? Neanderthal. The evidence now suggests that these were the bones of a hunched-over man who suffered severely from rickets, a disease caused by severe vitamin D deficiency. This condition causes a softening of the bones as well as defective bone growth. Those who have this disease are characterized by a bulky head, a crooked spine, and limbs and depressed ribs, among other things. I said, you might know this man. Let me read on. The evidence shows that Neanderthal man, when in good health, stood fully erect and walked in a normal fashion with a normal posture like modern humans. He certainly had a fully human brain capacity. The evidence shows that he sewed clothes from animal skins, built shelters, had a form of writing, practiced religious ceremonies, played musical instruments, made and used various tools, including axes, bores, scrapers, points and knives, fashioned stone arrowheads, used fire for cooking, painted pictures, used language to communicate, buried the dead, and even placed flowers upon the grave. Sometimes he buried the dead with various objects, suggesting the possibility that he had some kind of belief in the afterlife. He also displayed social care. Some skeletons show the marks of obvious injuries or illnesses suffered sometimes before death, evidence that there must have been social care to support certain ailing or disabled individuals. Now, these are not things one would expect of a savage ape-like creature. Clearly, Neanderthal man was a Homo sapien. Very interesting. And let's go down the list real quickly of them. I won't take a whole lot of time, but I'll just tell you a little bit of where what man later found out about him. Neanderthal, as you can see, the evidence of where they're found and what they can do, if they have language and they can speak in language, if they bury the dead, if they do all, doesn't sound like any ape I know of out there whatsoever. Next along the line after Neanderthal, they discovered Java man in Indonesia, back around the turn of the century, of the 20th into the 20th century. Well, Java man, there he is. That's one of the stepping stones of the evolution of man, from ape to man, right? Well, wrong. Took a while, but they finally discovered that, and understand today, in fact, that Java man was nothing more than an extinct gibbon in Indonesia. In 1912, two very famous scientists in England discovered what they call Piltdown man, P-I-L-T-D-O-W-N, Piltdown man. It took scientists who were trying to be honest, I'll put it that way, over 50 years to discover that it was a deliberate fraud. Tests reveal that the jawbone, these are not complete skeletons, by the way, of the head. A test revealed that the jawbone was that of a female orangutan, and it had been intentionally stained to make it appear to match the dark brown human skull. And put together, now they came to the top of the department. They got notoriety. And all the papers in London and in New York and elsewhere that showing here that here's man's ancestors, was all a hoax. Before World War II, Peking man was discovered in China. It took a while, but finally they discovered what was really taking place, Peking man, because they didn't have the full skull, and part of it was cut off the top and everything. It was nothing more than monkeys that were killed and eaten by workers at a lime quarry. They thought it was a delicacy to eat the brains. But that was part of man's evolution, and for several decades, people were being deceived by that. Then comes Nebraska man. In 1926, you had the Scopes trial in Tennessee. Because I forgot the individual's name there, who it was against the law to teach evolution, by the way. But he did anyhow. And so that's where the case came in Tennessee. And part of the prosecution, I guess it was in this case, they used Nebraska man, which had been discovered in 1922, 4 years before the trial, to make I get the two mixed up in this case, the ones who were trying to defend, the state side, God created and there was no evolution. So they brought up Nebraska man that was discovered, just had been discovered in 1922. Guess what? What was discovered? A single tooth was discovered, and paleontologists claimed it was a link in man's evolution. They were quickly running to get the notoriety and run to the top of the department in their universities. Guess what? It turned out to be an extinct wild pig. And, of course, they raise a lot of pigs in Nebraska, too. Now we come a little further this way. 1959, East African ape named Zinjanthropus, discovered by Louis Leakey and his wife in Tanzania. It was dated to be 2 to 4 million years old. It was featured in National Geographic magazine as a support for evolution of man. Guess what? It was later found to just be an ape that was extinct. 1974 in Ethiopia, Donald Johansson discovered Lucy. Again, that made all the headlines. Let me read here from Rhodes on this last one. That was the last one I've heard of that has been discovered, supposedly as showing the evolution of man. It was taught for a long time, I guess maybe it still is, that man evolved and came out of Africa because of these apes, prehistoric apes, or extinct apes, I should say. pick up where I want to go. Oh, I'm sorry. No wonder it didn't look right. Wrong page. Bear with me. I'll be there in a moment. As for the claim that Lucy could walk upright, the evidence reveals she could walk somewhat upright, much like pygmy chimps do today. She certainly could not walk fully upright like human beings. Lucy's knee structure points more to the tree-climbing abilities than the ability to be able to walk upright. Going on, despite all the media hoopla about alleged ape men, however, no hard evidence yet exists for their reality. No hard evidence. And you should ask for that when somebody wants to say that. And we know. I mean, look at the discoveries. There's Lucy. There's Zinjanthropus. There's all these others. No, there is no hard evidence. To be sure, we do not. We do have lots of fossils and bones of human beings. And we do have lots of fossils and bones of apes. But we do not have any fossils or bones of transitional ape men. Nor do we have any fossils demonstrating that human beings and apes derived from a common ancestor. The fossil record seems to indicate that apes have always been apes and humans have always been humans. And that's what the fossil record shows. But you have people making claims of fact that are not facts at all, and they, if they're challenged, could not back it up. They just could not. All right, I'm going to stop there with the portion on evolution, but I do want to go to Romans chapter 1. In Romans 1, this scripture certainly talks about includes our age, because of what he says. You can go back, even Greeks believed in evolution. They just didn't call it that. What they described was a type of evolution. In Romans chapter 1, verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. And yes, in the world's eyes, they are wise, and they profess to be wise. In God's eyes, they're fools. Twice in the book of Psalms, David said, only a fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Psalm 14:1, Psalm 53:1. Only a fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now let's switch over to the side of God. Of course, I've been a little bit by showing the mistakes and the things that are wrong with evolution that they cannot prove. Obviously, also in that shows the evidence that God must exist. In 1960, the church published an article entitled Seven Proofs God Exists. Those seven proofs today, I believe we have more evidence, more information to support those seven proofs than when that article was written. It is, I think, one of those articles that will always be a strong article. It's something that you can take as you read, whether you read books on the subject, and they are interesting because there's a lot of good scientists, creationist writers who really help fill in the seven proofs that God does exist. And now let me just go through them here in a short time. The first one that was given in the article was that law requires a lawgiver. James 4, verse 12 says, we have a lawgiver. And he was referring, of course, to spiritual law, but also physical law. You and I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for physical laws that are governing us being here. The gravity, the very earth, the very orbit that we are in around the sun, if we were any closer, we would burn up. We couldn't live. If we were any further away, we couldn't live. We would freeze. Life just could not exist. We are in the perfect distance of orbit around this sun. Our moon is in the perfect distance of its orbit around this earth. If it was closer, we would be flooded. The tides that would come in here would probably go all the way to the Appalachian Mountains. Florida would probably be covered from just the tides if the moon were closer to the earth in its orbit. Further away, it would just be the opposite effect, obviously. It is an incredible universe that we live in, and our Milky Way galaxy, we live in just the right area of that galaxy. If we lived in some of the other areas of the Milky Way galaxy, we would not exist. We could not. Life just cannot exist. We are in a perfect location. A book, which also has a DVD on it, that is well worth your time, that certainly shows that law requires a lawgiver, is entitled The Privileged Planet by Guillermo Gonzalez and by Jay Richards. The Privileged Planet. Some churches have shown the DVD, I believe. Somebody showed that at the feast one year, I believe. I don't know if we were at that feast. I'd have heard about it. But it is very, very well documented, showing how it is, there's just no other answer. And we do in the church, we do not have to be intimidated by people who think they're educated and that we cannot give an answer. Yes, we can give an answer, and we should, and should challenge them if they start saying how they have proven it's a proven fact. Yeah, let's see the proof. You're going to begin to see right away they don't have it. Law requires a lawgiver. Number two, life requires a life giver. We find over here in Genesis chapter 2, in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, it is God. You know, science has tried to see if they could create what I'll call flesh or living organisms. They thought they really were smart and they could do it. Guess what? Just couldn't make it live. That's the challenge. They never will. And they are never going to duplicate DNA. They never will. DNA is not just a matter of chemicals. There's information. DNA communicates. It communicates in our body. It communicates to the other organ systems in our body. The cells do. It is an incredible thing when you begin to what has been discovered on DNA. In Genesis 2, verse 7, and the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. He became a living being. God only can give life. And also, under life requires a life giver, there is the law of biogenesis, which states life can only come from life. How true. Life can only come from God. The originator of life is the one who has life, God. And he is the one, and of course, all physical life, whether it's plant or animal or human, comes from life and cannot, in no way can it be created. You can get all the, if you think you can create all the parts by bringing together, yes, we do have chemicals in our body. Of course we do. You know, this whole thing reminds me of the story in 1 Kings chapter 18. Elijah and the 450 priests of Baal. Ahab brought them out to challenge Elijah. Well, great, at Mount Carmel. And he said to the people, if Baal is God, we'll worship him. If God is God, you worship him. All right, you boys go first. And so all morning long, into the mid-afternoon, they are railing away, as you will read there in 1 Kings 18, tearing their skin, bleeding and everything. And finally, in the mid-afternoon, Elijah says, all right, you know, in essence, you guys have put on a good show, but now let's begin to get down to see what this is all about. you have not, did Baal... Is he traveling somewhere? Is he on vacation? Did he take a nap? Is he asleep? I mean, he really starts mocking them. And you can read it there, 1 Kings chapter 18, and it's about verse 27, 28 in there. He's having fun with them. And he said, now, bring over some water here and dump it on this this altar. And let's transform that and bring it up to the present day. Wouldn't that be interesting? Maybe we'd get a chance to do that in the kingdom of God. Let me take a little pile of dirt here, and I'll put it up here in this altar, and we'll pour some water on it and everything. I'm not going to just make a little cell live. I'm going to make a whole organism, a whole, either an animal, maybe even a human, who knows. See, God can do that. And how did he make us? How did he make Adam and Eve, or Adam be made from what? The dust of the ground. So that means there are chemicals. Yes, we are physical. And we, if you're taking supplements, what are those supplements? Those are chemicals that you need, right? And so, yes, but to me, it's a. I get a kick out of that story. And a lot of times when I see this, because the people that are so adamant about no God are almost like these ridiculous prophets of Baal who knew there was no Baal, but they're going to go through all, what do you call that, flagellations or whatever with the things that they, it says there, that how they were bleeding, tearing themselves all apart and everything. That is one of the things today, too. if God does exist, and we can certainly prove and see it, then people need to come to that God, to the only God, and bow down before him and want to submit to him. Why would people want to submit to something that is an imagination of their hearts and minds? Nothing but philosophy out of stubbornness. Out of stubbornness. And it's a shame. They're only destroying themselves. Life requires a life giver. Number three, creation requires a creator. Again, we have the scriptures in the Bible. 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Verse 3, nothing was made except by the Word of God. Jesus Christ created everything. Colossians 1, verses 15 through 17. He created everything that was created. He created that which was visible and invisible. He created the angels. Yes, creation requires a creator. It doesn't just happen. Now, some believe that a great bang took place. But there is a problem, and creationists have certainly pointed that out with the Big Bang theory, which of course is not evolution. Usually when you have an explosion, you don't have something come out that is phenomenally perfect. It's usually total destruction. Something like that happens. I guess as far as whether something like that happened or not, we'll have to wait for Christ to show and to tell us. But everything we see is in perfect order. Perfect order. And we are now discovering things that, and through the Hubble telescope, and I guess it's going to be replaced here in a few years by something even greater than that, the distances that we see, the things that we can do, it's just incredible. It's mind-boggling. I remember a couple of years ago, it's been now, where they discovered a star, and they were able, how they do their calculations, I don't know. That star was 13.5 billion light years away from the Earth. We were just now seeing that light, and we don't know whether that star is even in existence today, because it took 13.5 light years, according to the mathematical calculations, for that light we just discovered to get here for us to see it. Now, do you understand that? I mean, when you think about it, I just, no, of course not. I mean, we cannot understand anything so incredible and great as what God has done. Creation requires a creator. Number four, sustaining requires a sustainer. God sustains us. By the way, in the book of Acts, I'll give you the scriptures while turning to them here because I'm coming up on the end of time, my time. In Acts 14, verses 16 and 17, and repeated again, or actually the point is repeated, in Acts 17, verse 24 through 28, where Paul points out that how God sustains us. And you probably read right over that and didn't think about it in terms of the fact that God is our sustainer. But he is. And he sustains everything. What is keeping everything? Why is gravity sustained? What happens if all of a sudden gravity just disappears? Well, we might just start floating around in this room, wouldn't we? Everything is being sustained. Even our orbit around the sun is sustained. We put satellites up there in space around this Earth, and after a period of time, they are not sustainable, and they fall back into the atmosphere and disintegrate. Number five, design requires a designer. Today we call it intelligent design. This was 1960 when it was written. But how true it is. How in the world can anybody, any scientist, argue and deny intelligent design? Well, that's hinting at God. That's more than hinting. That's another way of saying that's right. That's right, without apology. And we shouldn't be so ignorant, willingly ignorant. In Psalm 19, David certainly put it to show that he looked up and he saw intelligent design. Psalm 19, and verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God. And the firmament shows his handiwork. And he goes on through that 19th Psalm. The heavens declare the glory of God. Why? Their design. They studied it anciently, the stars, and they saw the incredible design. And, of course, they studied things here on the earth, too. But they're out there. They didn't have any nightlights around from cities or anything would cause them to not be able to see. They saw millions and millions of stars up there. You and I may be lucky to see a half a dozen or whatever you out, at least where I live. You look up, I see a few around the moon, and out here I can see the Big Dipper and all of that. But I know there's an awful lot I'm missing out there. In David's day, they could be out on a mountain and really see quite a show. So design requires a designer. And certainly we do have, and it's intelligent design, it is God. Number six, fulfilled prophecy proves God. One that comes to mind immediately is the 70 weeks prophecy, Daniel, the 9th chapter, because we're going through it in Bible study down in our churches in South Florida. That is one of the most perfect and incredible prophecies of the first coming of Christ and, of course, the second coming, which is yet to take place. It tells you when you read it that it would be 400, I'll just tell you the fast track, 483 days or 483 years until the coming of the Messiah. Wants the decree to go out to rebuild the walls of the city of Jerusalem. You have it. It's recorded by Ezra, the seventh chapter. That took place in 457 B.C., and that's not just the Church of God that came up with that date. You can go to the Expositor's Bible Dictionary Commentary. It will tell you that's from the Persian records. It was 457 B.C., exactly, and come out exactly as ministry began in the fall of 27 A.D. And you don't have to say that, well, you're just coming up with that so it fits in with the calendar and Passover and all of that. No, it doesn't. It is in secular history. That starting date is correct. And there it is. Guess what? That is exactly when he began his ministry, the fall of 27 A.D. Many, many other prophecies have also been fulfilled. Today we have a Jewish state after 2,520 years. There is a Jewish state in the time of the end. Zechariah, the 12th chapter, shows there has to be a Jewish state in the time of the end. There is. Do you realize that it began in 1649 with the Pilgrims in England? Not Pilgrims, the Puritans in England, who were approaching the government to try to provide for a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. It continued in almost every government. It came into the United States and was a part of religion in the 19th century of conservatives wanting to petition in any way the United States government to try to have a Jewish, not so much a state, but a homeland in the Middle East. But it wasn't the appointed time. And after 300 years, 1948, the Jewish state began. Amazing. All the efforts were being made. You know, Napoleon was employed by the rich Jews in Paris, that when he invaded Egypt and he was going to go to the British fortress and so forth in Haifa, which is today a major city and port in Israel, that the Wellington, the British commander, intercepted his ships, took his cannons, and turned them later on him and his fleet and defeated him. He was not able to get to the glorious land. He got Egypt. He went into the pyramids. He failed. You know why he failed? Because it wasn't the appointed time. He was going to open up the door because he was accepting the money from the Jewish millionaires and people in Paris. It wasn't time. And so he was defeated at that particular battle that took place. You can read about that in history. It's fascinating. All right, let me move on. There are many, many things of fulfilled prophecy that proves there can only be a God for that to happen. It just doesn't happen by time and chance. And finally, the last one, the most important one probably of all, answered prayer proves God. Answered prayer. And when somebody is sick unto death, and I've seen a few who have been, and a prayer of faith was given, they certainly looked to God, and God interceded. Now, does he do it every time? Well, Paul, he didn't heal Paul on occasion. And Paul said, I thank God. I take pleasure in my infirmities. 2 Corinthians 12. Yet on the other hand, we've seen people who have been healed of cancer. I know of two that I've personally known and seen who should, by all rights, have been dead. And would be, except that they were miraculously, God intervened and healed them. Now, it doesn't have to just be healings because of the sickness. It can be many other things, too. I've seen people's lives saved from drowning and other things because they cried out to God and he sent an angel and helped them to get out to the shoreline. And when, well, practice right here, you know what I'm talking about. Not in this congregation, but one of the three that's pastored by this pastor. And when they got out of the river to turn and thank the man for his help, he was gone. He's gone. Remember the story there in Acts when Angel came and got Peter out of jail, helped him right through, the doors opened for him, and as they went out, got him into the street and headed him in the right direction, and Peter, you know, was not sure he was in his right senses. He wanted to turn to talk, and the guy was gone. It was gone. And that's happened in our time, in our generations too, with people where that kind of thing has taken place. You see answered prayer. One of the great proofs of God is answered prayer. Well, now the evolutionists are going to have a problem with both fulfilled prophecy and answered prayer, aren't they? Unless they submit themselves to God and recognize and admit and ask for forgiveness of their stubbornness and unbelief. Well, let's end this by going to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3, because I think this would be an appropriate scripture to end on. In 1 Peter 3 and in verse 15, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness, humility, and fear." Well, I hope this helps us, brethren, to be aware of the major problems with evolution and to appreciate the wonderful proofs of God.